Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Boop. You have been unmuted.
Mr. Foreman, on docket number 2282CR117001, murder in the second degree, what say you? Is the defendant of our guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Kevin, guess what we're doing?
We're doing maybe the last readathon.
No way.
We're doing the last breaking news.
Nope.
Don't know what happened.
Nah.
Not going forward beyond this.
Oh, yes, we are.
Readathon.
And who are you?
Who am I?
Yes. I'm Rebecca Lavoie.
Oh,
who are
I'm
you?
Kevin Flynn.
Oh, gosh, you would think you would have learned. And who are you?
I feel like that was a big existential question that he was about to give us a big answer for. But no, I am Mel Barrett, the host of the In Between podcast, an investigative true crime podcast.
Okay, so anyone listening to this podcast already knows the outcome of this trial, probably, but we will just repeat it for you.
002, what say, is the defendant at the bar not guilty or guilty?
Not guilty.
Of?
Is not guilty or guilty about that charge or any lesser included charge? Thank you. Specifically number 5, operating under the influence of liquor by operating a motor vehicle with a blood alcohol level of 0.08 or greater, correct?
Yes.
So say you, Mr. Foreman?
Guilty.
So say you all?
Yes. Guilty.
003, what say is the defendant at the bar leaving the scene after accident resulting in death, defendant not guilty or guilty? So say you, Mr. Foreman?
Karen Reed has been found not guilty of all of the major charges against her, except for one misdemeanor operating under the influence charge, for which Hank Brennan recommended the standard sentence of 1 year of probation plus alcohol education. And obviously the defense agreed. And so Karen Reed is free. She is not going to prison, and she has been acquitted of all of these charges. Mel, what are your thoughts on the verdict?
First of all, I was sick to my stomach because of what we, I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk about it, but that, you know, false start that we had.
The big psych moment?
Made me feel crazy.
Yeah,
so do you want me to get into it?
Sure, or
do you
just explain what happened.
So basically, we heard that everyone was coming back to the courtroom, so we all sort of rushed back to our screens to see what was going on, and Bev comes out and she says,
all right, I appreciate you all getting back here. During the luncheon break, I received word from a court officer that the jury had knocked on the door, indicating that they had a verdict. But before I could even summons everybody into court, you know, shortly thereafter, they knocked again and said they didn't have a verdict. So I asked the court officer to tell them to put that verdict slip in an envelope and seal it. And to give it to us. Paul, do you have it? I haven't seen this. It's been sealed. I'm now going to seal it in the legal sense. So this is sealed. No one will have access to it. It will be preserved and made part of this record. I'm going to ask it to be marked for identification with the word jury, Chrissy, just to keep it separate and apart from everything else. So it's marked for ID with the word jury. All right, so we do not have a verdict because, as we all know, there is no verdict until it is announced and recorded in open court. So we are still awaiting a verdict. Because it took a while to pull this together, I would ask that everybody remain in the building until the end of the day. So we'll see everybody later.
Thank you.
And I thought we're coming back on Friday.
Just for those who weren't there,
Bev didn't literally say "just kidding." That's Mel.
And I will say I just heard from Colin Miller, law professor and expert, literally on trials all over the country. He said he's never, ever heard of that happening. So if you're hearing people on TV say it happens, it actually doesn't. This is incredibly unusual, and I was left to wonder. Kevin, maybe you can give me your opinion on this. Maybe they were just worried they filled out the verdict slip wrong.
I mean, that could be it.
It's hard to imagine.
It's hard to imagine that, like, within 5 minutes, 12 people changed their mind. Like, wait a second. Hold on.
Maybe they just made a mistake.
Could have been making a mistake. It also really could have been one person with super cold feet, like, I don't know if I want to. Because certainly it seemed like to get in the head, we won't know till we hear from the jurors. But it seemed like when that question came up, that this is the outcome they wanted. They're like, well, I mean, it's pretty clear that she had been drinking and driving.
Right.
We've been asked to look at that. Yeah, we should. We're guilty on this, but we're unclear. If we check this box, does this mean this other thing? And did not get any sort of clarity on it.
Nope.
So I can imagine there are people who are like, hey, no way am I going to say guilty on this if I think it's going to be this lesser charge, if I think it is this, you know, the major charge. And that could have been where people have been for the last few hours.
So I saw the new verdict slip that was issued to the jurors today. And it was, I think, better than the previous one, but it was unnecessarily like onerous. It was like, if you check this, stop here and sign the verdict slip. If you check this,
sounds
stop
like a
here.
Tax form.
It sounded very much
like go to line 56.
A choose your own adventure book situation. Instead of just saying, you know, not guilty on this charge does not mean this. I mean, I feel like it could have been clearer, but it definitely was an improvement. And I laud the defense for really pushing for that because it was necessary. And I give the jury a ton of credit for their incredibly smart questions, which I think informed, you know, a lot of what they then did after and what they received after. Apparently, Sue O'Connell, during Judge Beverly Cannoni walking them through the new verdict slip, said that some of them were nodding vigorously, as in, oh, I get it now.
Oh, yes.
That makes sense. Because, you know, as we said, it looked like if you were guilty on OUI, you were supposed to check that top box. So I have a question for you, Mel. Were you surprised to hear Hank Brennan recommend the standard OUI sentence for Karen and Rita? Bev wanted to push it off a week, the sentencing, and they were both like, we're ready now. And then he said a month.
Yeah, I was actually shocked that Bev didn't want to get it over with now because she's got a 4-day weekend ahead of her and she can go to the Cape. And I couldn't believe that she would want to come back in a week again. And
with these people.
I know, with these people, Alan Jackson. Maybe, I think there's some sexual tension between Bev and Alan Jackson.
Yeah, that's it.
I think she hates him because she loves him.
That's right. Get a room already, Bev.
I know, right? No, I think that I won't say I was shocked necessarily. I think Hank also wants to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
I think he's like, oh, shit, you know? But at the same time, he also got paid. He was a hired gun, you know? He did what he could do with what he had.
Yeah.
So I think he wanted to get out of here. And I have to say, I have a lot of respect for him for saying, you know, just probation. And because he could have been a dick. He could have been like, yeah, we wanted to serve those 2.5 years.
I'd have more respect for him if he hadn't played so dirty at the trial. I don't have respect for him for that. He just did what was standard. Mm. And I don't think we should hold people to a bar where when they do what's standard, we are giving them kudos, because that is literally the baseline.
I was just trying to give him a little something.
I know.
I've been so hard on him the whole time.
Well, it's tough on white men, Rebecca. Come on.
Really did you guys see the photo of him driving away from court the other day when he was wearing his... this is the day we were there, Kevin. He was wearing his AirPods in his car as he was driving with the window open. I think he might be a smoker. His voice certainly sounds like he's a smoker. Yeah. So he seems like one of these people who'd wear his AirPods because he can't hear on his speaker with the window open while he's smoking.
I can't imagine having a Nick fit in the middle of that trial.
God. That's why they have so many breaks.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, did you see Lally last year? Every chance he got,
smoking,
he was outside on a smoke break.
Like a chimney.
Yeah.
It's like doctors outside an ER. They all fucking smoke.
Yep.
They got to do it. They got to do it. But this jury slip, I mean, you're absolutely right. This was a big problem with the first jury,
it was
right?
The problem with the first trial.
It was the problem.
Yeah, I mean, the lack of clarity. And Bev keeps saying like, oh, well, I can park in my driveway horizontally. That's legal, but it's not practical, right? So I'm not breaking the law. So just a little common sense within the bounds of the law.
Yeah.
Let's just redo this. I mean, this is something every judge in the Commonwealth is going to think about. How are my jury slips? Am I okay with the way I'm doing this? Have I ever had a problem?
As they should, though.
Yeah.
As they should. And I'm so glad that this became such a big point in these two trials, because I'm hoping that going forward, I mean, I'm not going to put any faith in the Commonwealth that they're going to learn any lessons from this, but I do hope that they will. I mean, I think that investigations, the way they do investigations needs to be different. The way that they deal with the public needs to be different. They need to have some accountability. And as far as these, you know, slips go, God knows how long that verdict slipped has been around in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, probably like 200 years old or some shit.
Yeah.
And it's time for things like that to change, because you are asking a jury of your peers, of the defendant's peers, to make a decision about the rest of their lives. And if it's confusing, it shouldn't be.
Mm.
When you're making a major decision like that, it should be pretty cut and dry as far as what, you know, you're putting on a piece of paper.
I think that another lasting legacy of this trial could be, or this whole case could be, a reexamination of the witness intimidation statute in the state of Massachusetts. That statute has been weaponized this entire time. It's been weaponized ever since Aidan Carney got involved in the case in 2023. So it's been weaponized for more than 2 years by people who are pretending to be afraid of what is being said publicly about them, which is just speech.
And also people who are protesters or advocates are being targeted by law enforcement as well.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. People standing outside with signs. They were arrested for, quote, picketing. People, this has been...
The Canton fence thing is just amazing.
To me, the saga of the this ducks. Has been incredible. And I think, you know, another lasting legacy to go with that is the political blurring of lines here. I know now so many people online and have communicated with people, including Turtle Boy, who are polar different from me in terms of values, in terms of what they think about today's discourse and, you know, how they feel about certain issues. People coalesced around this issue. They coalesced around being suspicious of the police. They coalesced around prosecutorial misconduct issues, and they coalesced around actual free speech, not pretend this is a free speech issue, but real free speech issue. So I think there's like a civics lesson here that I'm just thrilled that people were brought together by this in so many ways.
I agree. And I think that it's a broader lesson, like you're saying. I think it's actually, it does, you know, seep into our political discourse as well. Because I think at the end of the day, what we don't sort of realize is that a lot of us are on the same side when it comes to social issues and things like that. I think, you know, a lot of us can, we can have our opinions and we can think different things and we can feel different things, but a lot of us are actually on the same side when it comes to the government and their, you know, power and control over us. And I wish that more of us would sort of come to realize that. I think it's starting to happen. I think when business owners who voted a certain way in the election are now going, oh my God, the people who work for me are being ripped away from their families and their kids. I didn't vote for this. And that's the point. You know, I do think we need to give a pretty major shout out. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think we need to give a shout out to Turtle Boy.
Absolutely.
Because honestly, nobody would even know about this case if not for him.
Agreed.
And nobody would know about the corruption in this case if not for Turtle Boy. And again, he is the antithesis of who I am politically, but I believe in his First Amendment right, and I'm glad that he exercised it in this case, because otherwise Karen Reed probably wouldn't have been able to raise $1 million, which is what she needed to fight this.
Right. She has more than $5 million in legal expenses, so says Alan Jackson in that ID special. And of course, there have been more expenses since then, the hiring of ARCA, new experts. And think about all the experts they hired that they didn't end up using. They still have to pay those bills, right?
Yeah.
Thank God they didn't get the carpet tested, huh?
So, Kevin, what do you think about sort of the legacy of this? What do you see as some lasting effects potentially of this case?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's the political fallout, right? And that who I'm thinking of most is the district attorney,
Morrissey.
Mm-hmm. Morrissey.
You heard those chants outside the courtroom.
Yeah,
Morrissey sucks.
Because if we ever get to the second part of this, which is taking the evidence that has been uncovered and charging the real killer of or real killers of John O'Keefe. Because there is a huge roadmap here. And if Karen Reed had never come back to the scene or whatever that morning, I think the first responders would have suddenly looked at
Lucky Loughran
would have
probably
looked at the people inside and would have gone inside and like and started asking some of these questions before they went pot committed on what the story was. I think that the only way this is going to happen is when there's a new district attorney, because this district attorney is not going to say, well, we're going to, you know, the jury has spoken and that wasn't the actual killer. And
no,
so
he's going to say the
opposite. He's not going
to
do that. But a new district attorney might come in and say, OK, you know, maybe more artfully than this, but fuck these guys, all these guys who are here. You're out. Go get reassigned. I want new people in here.
New cops.
And we're looking at this again.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just and the big mystery still remains the FBI.
Right.
What were they specifically looking at in the first place that got them here? What did they find out? They weren't just knocking on doors and fucking around. They hired ARCA. They went places. They, you know, they convened a grand jury and brought every one of
those
dirty
fuckers
in. They spent a lot
of money and time, yeah.
They spent a lot of time. They were pretty sure. They weren't just kicking the tires on this. They were pretty sure they had a case, just like with Sandra Birchmore. So I think there's a fallout that's going to come regarding the district attorney. Perhaps the FBI can complete its work. We know it's complicated because the Trump administration does not want the Justice Department investigating things that are, quote, civil rights issues. And while and that's usually the auspices under which the federal government looks at local law enforcement. And even though this isn't what most people think of as a civil rights issue, as a racial justice issue, this still would be, well, you know, check this box, a civil rights case, because the FBI can't charge somebody for a local murder unless there's a federal
There
tie
might be
in.
A federal component they, because he was an officer of the law.
Could be. Or they could say, you violated Karen Reed's rights.
Yes.
Who knows?
I honestly think when I was listening through the second trial and I was trying to think, what triggered the FBI to start investigating? And I started thinking about Higgins. I mean, he's federal. He's ATF. He destroyed his phone. He showed up to one of his first interviews with a lawyer. There was video footage of him. And when they started investigating it and they talked to Dever and they find out it's weird that they're in the Sally Port, I'm just wondering if they were triggered because somebody contacted them about Higgins.
I think there's an excellent chance that the Reed team knew about the Sandra Birchmore investigation because that was something that was kind of in the ether.
Yeah.
And contacted the FBI and said, if you're looking at this office, you should also look at this. That's a possibility, but I do think Higgins' involvement is an intriguing piece of this. He is the only he's the only person that we heard of who was interviewed by police with a lawyer present the first time. You know, we heard you know, that the FBI showed up at Jen McCabe's house and Jen McCabe pretended to be her sister. You know, and it's so funny that I keep thinking about that answer. I thought they were salesmen. Have you ever seen FBI agents in the field and what they drive and what they look like? They look like G-men. FBI agents don't walk around wearing, you know, they can't be confused with Jehovah's Witnesses or confused with, you know, Mormons on mission. They look like FBI agents. And
oh, I believe around that. I want to be like, fuck this guy. I don't want that. I don't, whatever you're selling, I don't want.
Would you
want
pretend
it
to be your somebody else?
Yeah, I don't know, I suppose.
But what would make her think that the salespeople would approach her in a parking lot, follow her to her house, and then go up to her
it's
front
the Fuller
door?
Brush men. They're very, very dedicated to their work.
Okay. And call her up by name, right? Yeah.
Okay, but, and do we actually have salespeople in the streets anymore?
No.
Is that a thing?
Nope.
That's
we have
like
Jehovah's
50s.
Witnesses, and that's about it.
I'm starting to see holes in Jen's story.
My goodness. You mean Nicole's story.
So one thing that I'd like to say is that so much of the evidence in this trial would not be there were it not for the FBI investigation.
Correct.
If it were not for the FBI investigation, it would be Karen Reed's weak word against these law enforcement folks' stronger word. I mean, Karen Reed herself has admitted she's unsure. You know, I don't think she super remembers what happened that night and all that stuff.
That's why she was convicted of an OUI charge.
And she, I don't think would have, I mean, I know she wouldn't have had a case were it not for these thousands of pages of documents from this parallel investigation that led them down the alley of crash reconstruction and that revealed to them that there had been a grand jury and that revealed to them that there was a completely different opinion of the case that had been sent to the district attorney's office. They sent them a letter saying, we recommend you don't go forward with this because we don't share your opinion of the case. And the district attorney's office, their response was to say, fuck you, move your case to a different jurisdiction. We're moving forward with our theory.
And the fact that when after the FBI was involved, the prosecution, the DA's office still withheld evidence the defense after the feds were involved. Why did they have that kind of audacity? That's my question. Like, what did they think their
power
was?
Because it's worked for them before. That is what's happening here. These people, this is how they close and convict cases. They put their thumb on the scales. I bet all of this shit has worked for them before, and they were just using their same playbook.
If the prosecution, this question has been plaguing me for days. If the prosecution had access to those x-rays for the past 3 years, 4 years, when did the defense get them?
Okay. I heard something about the defense getting them in May. However, I've heard another story, and what Karen Reed told the press was that they had them, but they didn't introduce them into evidence. Now,
who didn't?
The prosecution. Now, that is state evidence. So that is their evidence to introduce. The only witness who could bring them in is the person who took the x-rays, or the person who ordered the x-rays, and that was Dr. Irini Scordibello.
Right.
They never asked her about them. They weren't in evidence. So it really, I think, what she was trying to convey, I think, was that it kind of tied their hands about what they could or could not do. But then when Welcher brought up no x-rays, no broken bones, a door was opened for them to then bring them in.
Welcher.
I don't know 100% for sure if that's the case, but that seems to be what she was indicating when she gave that interview.
But can you imagine if that's actually our justice system?
It is.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
The fact that one of the pieces of information in this case that would prove that John wasn't hit by a car was the fact that he had no broken bones in his arm, in his entire body.
Right.
And because the prosecution.
But they didn't do an MRI, remember. It could have been a soft break.
No. But because the prosecution didn't bring it up, it is not evidence. How is that frigging possible? If you are there to prove that he was hit by a car and he has no broken bones, then he wasn't hit by a car.
Right.
I don't understand.
There
it.
Was
I mean,
no
that's
collision.
Just me being a layperson and being frustrated with the justice system. But I think Welcher was their downfall, one of their downfalls, but
the veracity of all of their experts, I think, was a big downfall.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even their own experts like Irini Scordibello, you know, she wasn't for them.
Right.
Well, it's funny that this time was for both sides, a much more streamlined presentation. Yeah. We didn't get, and almost with the exception of Jen and a couple of other people, we didn't get the big players from the party and the after party and all that other stuff. The jury wasn't told the same kind of story that intrigued most of us. We were looking for a sequel. It's like, okay, bring Trooper Paul on again and fuck him up and bring on Proctor and really make him look like an asshole. And we didn't get any of that. And so it was a much more elegant case for both sides. And it was a bit of a risk, I thought, for the defense.
Oh, I don't think so.
I think they were way ahead of the game.
As Colin Miller wrote to me today, usually he's a student of second trials. That's actually one of his areas of expertise.
Oh,
and he said, usually the first trial, the defense has somewhat of an advantage because the prosecution doesn't know what their case is going to be, but they know what the prosecution's case is going to be because of disclosure stuff. Mm-hmm. In Massachusetts, and in this case in particular, because of reciprocal discovery, the prosecution had more of an edge the first trial than they normally would, but they still were behind the ball a little bit. In the second trial, usually the prosecution learns all the lessons and the defense tries to do essentially the same thing.
Catch up.
He has never seen a defense. You know, what he said was, clearly the defense here learned more lessons from trial one than the prosecution.
They were
did.
On the offense for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that them.
They didn't change their story.
But hinting.
They just changed what they wanted to do and how
they
wanted
to. It.
Yeah, how they told it.
Yeah.
They, for the jury, lowered the bar for what they needed to determine.
Right.
Right. Yeah. They didn't have to sit there today and think about, oh, well, I
227.
You know, 227. I don't know about this.
It.
And well, you know,
so
did all these people do all this other stuff and. In essence, put themselves in the place of providing an affirmative defense that you have to believe that this conspiracy happened with all these different players. Otherwise, you can't acquit and instead just put up a whole bunch of shit.
They didn't box themselves in.
Yep.
No.
And then they said, is there reasonable doubt? Then you must acquit.
So one of the things that we've talked about, Mel, is the intelligence of the defense. And we both thought it was an error, like maybe a mistake when it was happening. They invoked the third party culprit theory. And then Hank Brennan played pre-ball before the ball game, doing so much minutia in his questioning about things like the 227 search. And so I think that may have left the jury with the impression the prosecution doesn't have much except for these, like, trying to, who cares about it? And then Jackson in his closing saying, just look at what the search says. Don't worry about what time it's at. I'm like, that was so fucking smart.
Yeah.
Do you still think that?
Yeah. Why didn't she Google hypothermia? I think that. Because
she can't spell hypothermia.
She can't spell how.
She's from Canton.
Canton.
Hypothermia.
I think that in both trials, the prosecution felt like they needed to get way out ahead of all the bad things for them. So the last trial, they spent the entire time dealing with the Proctor issue. They got way ahead of that issue. This time, they got way ahead of the third-party culprit issue. And I think that that muddied things for them. I think they got tangled up in their own shoelaces because of it. And
no one's talking about Ian Whiffen in that deliberation room. I guarantee it.
I forgot about Ian Whiffen. Completely forgot about him. He's the one who
says he has an idea of why Jen's search got deleted, but he's tried to replicate it and he couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's the guy who tried to do the demonstration for the jury.
Yes. And it was so confusing. Google's.
He had an English accent. That's what I remember. I think going into this in both trials, the prosecution knew they had a shitty case and they were being sort of forced to do this trial by probably Michael Morrissey.
Yeah. But Hank made a lot of dough. So he probably didn't have to be forced.
He did. But at the same time, they couldn't get anybody else to do it. So they brought Hank in. He's under the gun. He's got to, you know, do what they're asking him to do, and he has a shitty case, and he knows it.
Do you think that Lolly would have done a better job the second time around?
No. Oh, God.
I think here's what I think is different. I think, okay, so Hank, you know, certainly misrepresented a lot of the evidence, and, you know, set aside whether you think that's intentional or not, I think that one of the problems is legitimately Hank did not have a good handle on what the evidence was there and what it meant as Lolly did, and that contributed to some of the... Again, we'll call it misunderstanding. But Lolly knows, you know, Lolly should have, you know, said, no, those holes in the back of the, you know, of the sweatshirt.
What possessed him to do that? What possessed him to pull that moment? He's dealing with Alan Jackson, David Unetti, and Robert Alessi, and these guys don't miss anything. And the idea that he got up there and thought that he could get away with that in front of the jury, in front of the defense, in front of Karen, who's going to be like, what the hell? Karen knows this case inside and out.
She's been a lawyer
for
herself.
And in front of the Bev.
Yeah.
He knew he could get it past Bev because she was just like, you know, off playing some kind of game in her head or whatever. But the idea that he had the audacity to pull this in the moment, well, he prepared for it because he put it behind the witness stand. I'm just like, what was going through his mind when he was doing things like that?
Yeah.
Or when he was trying to tear down Dr. Russell, or when he was trying to tear down, you know, Dr. Wolf and Dr. Rentschler, like, and La Posada, who just handed him his lunch. It's like, I don't know. I don't know what he was thinking. But most of the time I was just going, what is wrong with this guy?
I think he believed that. I think he misunderstood a lot of it. I don't agree.
I think it was just strategy.
Why do they all with such conviction say, but there was, you know, glass and plastic or whatever embedded in his
because it
sweatshirt.
Worked last
Why
time.
Why does everybody?
Because he
you
has
heard
to
him
believe
say
that.
It. You heard him say it. She heard him say it. And they all just keep saying it. And it isn't until they finally got called in court and have a sidebar. He had to rephrase and said, when you saw there was a sweatshirt and the items were brushed off of it or whatever, he couldn't keep saying that.
Yeah.
And I just feel like he got some of this shit from TikTok.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It's also the easiest line to what they see as the facts in this case.
Or what they claim to see as the facts.
It's basically it's the Michael Proctor philosophy on investigations is what they used in this court case.
Yes.
They thought, oh, if we put taillight at the scene, then she did it.
Yep.
If there's a piece of John's hair on the bumper, then she did it.
Yep.
If his DNA is on the bumper, then she did it. If there are shards of, you know, if there's dust from the taillight in his sweatshirt, she did it.
Yes.
If there are holes in the sweatshirt that coincide with this part of his arm, then she did it. That was Michael Proctor's way of thinking.
Yes.
And it's like the prosecution went with that. And that was all they had.
There is a garbage in, garbage out thing to, you know, prosecutions. If you get bad information from investigators and that's what you have to work with, then sometimes you're like, I don't want to go to trial with this. Or you're like, well, I guess I got to go to trial with this,
yeah.
You know?
This, yeah.
I just want to mention another thing that Colin Miller told me is that by far the clearest appealable issue in this case, by far, clear as day, is the dog DNA issue.
Mm.
That Hank Brennan asked that witness a question about dog DNA, which was not in evidence, and that he had promised a rebuttal witness to bring that into evidence and hadn't done that. So, so that was just a clear constitutional violation. And that was like clear. There's a name for it that I don't remember, but clear grounds for appeal. Can I just mention one side story that happened today?
Sidebar.
As we were waiting for the verdict. Let's have a sidebar, shall we?
Let's have a sidebar.
Meet me at sidebar.
Our favorite journalist in this case is John DePietro. Just kidding. He's not our favorite journalist in this case. He's my least favorite.
I was wondering if you were going to bring this up.
And I just want to mention a couple things about John DePietro. I read, Kevin, an article last night that I had kind of forgotten about that I then remembered and showed him last night. In 2018, John DePietro was caught lying about his radio show's ratings. It was an Arbitron ratings fixing scandal where, you know, they send out these ratings books to people and they talk about how much time they've spent listening to a certain show. And whatever the ratings were for his show, it, like in the Rhode Island market, was like number four. It turns out that a bunch of ratings books, like four of them, which is a lot, right, Kevin?
Came
from his house. And then he blamed his wife. He threw his wife under the bus for cheating in the ratings. His show is actually number 9, and I'm sure that led to the end of his mainstream radio career. So anyway.
I didn't even know he had a mainstream radio career.
Yeah, this prize of a man, this prince of a guy, today.
Who was just so, he just so much wanted to, quote, bang her on a drunk driving charge.
Yes.
Because they got to get something.
That's what he says. And he's taking his word, bang her. So, Kevin, you remember the parking lot behind the Registry of Deeds across the street from the courthouse? Yeah. Kind of a tight little parking lot, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's space to get your car in and out.
Now, this is on video. He parked there today and he backed into, while parking, a truck from Texas that was driven there by some Karen Reed supporters who were there to join the stuff outside. He started walking away after parking his car until someone said, you just hit that car. And then he went back to his car, got a slip of paper, wrote a note that did not have his phone number on it or anything. It was like, here's my website, johndepietroshow.com. And what's so funny about it is the taillight on the truck cracked in exactly the same manner that Officer Barrow says Karen Reed's taillight was cracked after backing in to John O'Keefe's SUV.
The pieces and putting it in the bed of the truck.
It was incredible. What did you think about that karmic moment?
I was just like, when you sent me that video, I was like, is this really John DePietro? And the woman was just like, it's John DePietro. Look at him. Is that how a taillight smashes? Is that how it happens, John? It didn't shatter into 47 pieces. It's only in like 3 pieces. Did you guys see it's John DePietro? She was just like running around trying to get everybody that she could. And like, and then at the end of the video, there was like 3 or 4 women with their phones out, just like recording him and recording the truck and recording. And I was just
recording
like,
him,
she's like,
I got it on my dash cam. genius moment.
Gotta leave that note, otherwise
karma.
One thing I thought was interesting was after the verdict, William Reed, Karen Reed's dad, he gave remarks to the media outside and then remarks to the media by his car, and both times he made a point to mention content creators who had gotten more information into the ether and raised public awareness of the case. And we were watching a newscast, and the newscaster was like, well, as you saw there, that was a kind of an unusual comment that he would. But he said it's because they got more information out there to the public. They fucking knew what they were doing, and they were not dummies when it came to this. What'd you think of that, Mel?
I thought it was really interesting. And I was listening to some other.
You're welcome, obviously. Dad.
Obviously. No, I was thinking, you know, it really has moved from sort of a mainstream media. And I sort of jump back and forth, and I'll watch YouTube lawyers, and I obviously listen to our show. I was listening to your show well before I, you know, kind of came on to this and started talking with you. And I loved the way that you covered it, because you weren't just covering what was happening in the trial every day. You were covering what was happening outside with the people in the community. And that was really important to me. When you watch mainstream sort of markets or news, they're not supposed to be biased, but They really, really are.
Yeah.
And you can hear it in the way
facts
that they
and
explain.
Evidence. They ignore facts and evidence. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have a it feels to me like often the mainstream media is going to always be on the side of the prosecution, no matter what, because that's justice and that's our justice system and blah, blah, blah. And so I feel like they have to report that way. But social media and independent journalists and independent bloggers like Turtle Boy, like you, you were able to get this story out with meaning and with consequence. Mm-hmm. And
impact, that they call that. And
good job, Rebecca. Radio. Good job.
Yeah, good job, Kevin. Good job,
hey,
Mel.
I'm gonna bring up the one mainstream
exception.
You did
100 episodes before I came along, so let's just be clear about that.
this is only probably for interest of the people in greater Boston, but the one outlet that leaned into this in a different way was mm-hmm. the NBC station, Channel 10, because they branded yep. this, not as the Karen Reed trial, but their ongoing coverage was Canton Confidential,
yeah.
which is
yeah.
a little bit sensational or whatever, mm-hmm. but it is not a cut and dry, down the middle journalism thing for a story about a dead cop.
Sometimes they have idiots right? on, and sometimes they have smart people on.
They are acknowledging the fact that there is more to this story
yeah.
and lean yeah. into that, as opposed to a New York Times article where it's like, is she a femme fatale? And, you know, with
right.
absolutely... They understood that there was something more than just the testimony at the surface.
I also want to give props to Michelle McPhee, who reported the story for LA Magazine beautifully, mm. and Vanity Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever yep. anybody says, I don't know anything about this case, where should I start? I always send them that two-part Same. Vanity Fair piece, which was so complete and yep. included all of the things that were not, like all the things that were suspicious, which are collectively like they tell a story that mm. none of the media around here seem to want to tell. And as journalists, we can be snobby about the tactics and ethics mm-hmm. of some of these people who are reporting online. The thing we cannot be snobby about is the fact that they reach way more people than we do.
Mm.
Turtle yeah. Boy reaches way more people than, you know, a newspaper. Turtle Boy reaches way more people than a local yeah. radio station. And, you know, I give him credit for, despite some of his tactics, getting his facts right and protecting his sources, which made him superbly sourced, which is why he had what he had. The defense team was feeding him stuff. Lucky Loughran, he gave his first interview ever to Turtle Boy. Lots of people yeah. involved in the case. That was, we know about the Canton fence guy because of Turtle yeah. Boy. Like, so I give right. him a lot of credit, and the audience building instinct along with knowing the First Amendment rights, along with understanding the general rules of journalism. Like, he doesn't always check everything twice before he runs with it. But, you know, I just think it's something that we need to pay attention to.
You know, Mel, we were talking Agreed. Earlier about sort of like the legacy here. And I keep wondering, like, and this was brought up by Vinnie Politan on Court TV. When you see these trials, with the mm-hmm. exception of celebrities,
yep.
the public almost never has championed the defendant.
Right.
Right? All the big trials are about, can we convict this guy, this girl? And like, if there's a question, it's like, well, no, somebody else came in with the gun or what? I mean, mm-hmm. something very straightforward. And I think one of the reasons why the story took off is because the alternative theory was so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It wasn't just like, no, it was a different car that hit him, right? It was this whole yeah. other thing. And then you start adding all the bits of evidence. And I was trying to think back, well, why did I start thinking about this? The idea of the dog bites. The idea that there was yeah. an FBI parallel investigation. The idea that everybody got rid of their phone and deleted text messages. And I'm like, shit, that's sus. And so that's why people bought into it. I don't know how many, I mean, all those people went to the courthouse, were there for Karen Reed. I don't know how many people who are following this and are interested in this are there for Karen so much as they are for the whole story and get the, you know, let's get this right and the whole, make sure that, you know, there's the corruption angle and all that mm-hmm. other stuff. That's not to say that Karen Reed isn't likable, but she's also a divisive figure. You can still sure. find Karen Reed off-putting
Don't
or
find
harsh
her
or
off-putting.
Whatever.
That's just
but
not cool.
Still think that, you know, this is an important case, right?
Yeah, I actually have a real problem with that Karen Reed is off-putting and harsh thing. Granted, those voicemails, not great. I wouldn't want to date her. But maybe she's learned from this, you know, too. But like, she seems fine to me, and she seems funny, and she's a fucking fighter, and you have to
yeah,
admire that.
She's
At
a
least
fighter.
I have to admire mm-hmm. that.
I would say, Kevin, I think you're right. I think that we've seen some changes in the way that these stories about these cases are told. You know, I started noticing that when something is happening within your community and you have the means to discuss it publicly, well, like the way the Turtle Boy did, but I'll compare it to the Alec Murdaugh trial as well, because the people who actually broke that story were local people to that community, local lawyers and reporters to that community.
Mandy Matney.
Mandy Matney, and who really started looking into the corruption. And it started with Stephen's case. It didn't actually start with Alex's case.
Yep.
So when they started pulling that layer back, it reminds me so much of Sandra Birchmore, when, because, you know, Sandra Birchmore happened, the community is outraged about her case. And the same thing is probably going to happen. But for Sandra Birchmore, you know, when that trial happens, the same way that it happened for, you know, in the Alec Murdaugh trial, they exposed a family for 100 years has been taking, you know, advantage of people in that area,
keeping them under their thumb,
And so I agree with you, Kevin. I think actually what's happening is these, you know, YouTube channels and the Turtle Boys and, you know, the readathon, what's happening is we are, our interest is piqued because these are people just like us who are, injustice is happening. And so we need to talk about it and we want to research it and we want to try to tell everyone else about it so that other people are informed. And that's the newest form of media as far as justice is concerned.
Yeah.
I think Turtle Boy is going to go on. He's probably going to try to do the same thing with the Sandra Birchmore case. Mm-hmm. I think that we're going to try to talk about the Sandra Birchmore case. I wonder, and I want to ask you guys this question because you've been around these kinds of trials for a really long time. I mean, I'm thinking of the Pamela Smart trial, but imagine if, I'll say this, let me just tell a personal. Pam emailed me the other day and she said, I just wanted to let you know that they just gave us more television channels. I've only had access to ABC for 35 years.
Oh my gosh.
Oh.
And they just gave us, and she's like, and for the first time, I saw some Karen Reed trial coverage. And she's like, I could have used that. I could have used someone really trying to tell my story back then. Mm. And then today, as soon as the verdict came in, Darlie Routier's sister texted me and she was like, what do you think? You know, and I was like, she's like, are you ecstatic? And I said, yeah, I'm really happy that justice was served. And I was like, I wonder if, even though the cases are closed, I wonder if this kind of coverage and this kind of sort of thoughtful investigating and diving into these cases is going to help other cases like Darlie's or Pam's or, you know, whoever else, the Menendez brothers, whoever else it might be. But tell me your opinion, having been around these trials for a really long time, how would this have changed things 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago?
You know, if you're using that time frame, that's before like hot social media. At least it's before TikTok and the way TikTok and the you know those similar platforms affect things, where you have a lot of citizen commentary. I think that 10 years ago, I mean, this would have been covered in a much straighter, colder, kind of just the facts, ma'am, kind of way, you know. And it was,
or it would have been all about Karen and her demeanor.
Yeah, right. I mean, you still have. I mean, think Court TV went away and then it came back, but yet like that coverage would just sort of be like her face.
Well, that's the morning coverage on Horror TV. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. That is how they're covering it in the morning on the Julie Grant show.
Yeah.
They just don't like her face.
So
yeah.
I have some breaking news. There is a statement here from Jennifer McCabe, Matthew McCabe, Chris Albert, Julie Albert, Colin Albert, Nicole Albert, Brian Albert, Carrie Roberts, and Kurt Roberts.
So what? Noel Keith.
All together?
Yes, a McAlbert statement.
A McAlbert statement. All right.
Quote,
no Higgins.
Today, our hearts are with John and the entire O'Keefe family. They have suffered through so much and deserve better from our justice system. While we may have more to say in the future, today we mourn with John's family and lament the cruel reality that this prosecution was infected by lies and conspiracy theories spread by Karen Reed, her defense team, and some in the media. The result is a devastating miscarriage of justice. I wouldn't say more publicly, guys, if I were you. I would just zip it.
Whoa.
Keep it
zipped. They need to zip. Because I don't think this federal case is, I don't think it's actually close.
Well, if she only took a plea, it would all go away.
That's right. But instead, we had a whole thing.
Now, did they release that statement or was it in a group chat?
Was it on Signal?
Exactly. All right. So I want to talk about what's next for this program. Mm-hmm. I would like to, for sure, ask you guys that are interested in going with me on a civil case journey, if there, in fact, mm-hmm. is a continuing civil case. Will you guys be there for that?
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, right. Can I say no?
Can we have conversations about the Sandra Birchmore case? Yes or no?
Yes,
please.
Great. And I just want the audience to know I am trying to line up some people other than Mel and Kevin, even though they're the best, just to give me their reactions. Other people in the podcast community who I know have been following this closely and may not be making content about the case, but are dying to talk about it. So mm-hmm. I have sent a mass email to them today, and so I'm hoping to put out some follow-up episodes in the next days with some names that you might recognize and love.
And I'd say that if you, dear listener, want to see Rebecca and Mel and other smart people talking live about this case, then you need to get to the True Crime Podcast Festival in Boston on July 18th to the 20th, because in addition to all the other great content, including recording by Crime Writers On, Rebecca is going to lead a panel.
Not a panel, just me and Mel, a conversation.
Oh, a conversation about
just,
what's
just
next.
Just me and Rebecca.
With
a
PowerPoint.
With a PowerPoint about wrapping this up and maybe what's going to come up in the future and what they'd like to see. So this would be, if you like the readathon, you're going to love it in person.
That's right. And you can get 20% off your tickets to that with a promo code what? CWO.
CWO.
Great. CWO.
I can't wait to talk to you more about more stuff. Thank you so much for coming with me on this 100-plus episode journey.
I feel like Yannetti. I want to cry.
Yeah. It was moving as hell.
He got me. When Yannetti started crying, that's when I started crying.
When
and
men
then
cry,
when
man.
Went over and grabbed Karen's dad in that big, giant man hug, I was just like, this is so amazing. The relief they must be feeling.
Yeah.
Men with feelings. It's so moving.
Can I just say one other thing?
Sure.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say I really appreciate you both. And thanks so much for having me on the readathon, because I didn't have anyone to talk to about this before. And now I have an outlet and I feel like we have great conversations. And I'm really appreciative and I love you guys and thank you.
Well, something tells me we're not done making stuff together yet, Mel.
Yes. Let's do it.
We'll have to talk.
And I will say that the other day when someone wanted to enter the Crime Writers On Facebook discussion group, and they were asked which of the crime writers is your favorite, someone said Ruby.
Aww, Ruby Jean.
True facts. Yeah.
True facts.
All right. Ruby Jean. Guys, thank you so much for joining me today.
Got it.
Thank you.
Crime Media. Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable Pocket Hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.